Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Good morning! A very, very good Saturday morning to you all. We have got a great show coming up for you. Our experiment today, if you want to take part at home, involves lemonade and raisins. So yeah, an edible experiment for you there. That's not actually what we're going to be doing. We're going to be making those raisins dance. So stay tuned to find out how. And joining me today, I've got the fantastic Charlie Cotton, who is a tree guardian, a sometimes Wikipedia editor, a PhD student, and the closest thing I know to a modern day philosopher. Charlie, thanks for joining me today. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Thanks very much for having me.
Have I told you that before, that I think you're a modern day philosopher?
You haven't, but you know, it's a good time for things to come out into the open. Yeah,
so. Just come out with some great questions sometimes. I think my favourite was, I think, having dinner with you once, and you were just like, what is the difference between ambition and greed? And, you know, that's something I'd never thought myself, but as soon as you asked, I was like, wow, I don't know. We had like a half hour conversation about it.
It's got to keep questioning everything, right? I ask that one to a lot of people, and people have very different answers, but it's good to keep people thinking, right? And you got to ask as many diverse people as you can to see where they come from it. But yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So as well as all of those things, as I said, you're a PhD student, so you're a bona fide scientist. Could you tell us very briefly what you are studying?
So I work on carbon fixation, which is the way that photosynthetic organisms take carbon dioxide out of the air and what they can do with it. And we're looking at it to see if we can make it more efficient, or and also to check sort of how things evolved and why they are the way they are.
Cool. So looking at photosynthesis to see if we can potentially use it ourselves one day?
Yeah. So there's a big hype around using photosynthesis for making like valuable chemicals in the future. And I'm really interested from a renewable energy's perspective, because in the long run, we need to get off fossil fuels. And what can we learn from photosynthesis, and how can we go about using it to sort of help that transition? There's a lot of what I work on, yeah.
Oh, so cool. So that's quite a good way to introduce. There's a bit of a theme to today's episode, which is going to be quite an environmental episode, which is definitely one of Charlie's areas of expertise. So instead of a riddle this week, I've got, and keeping in line with, you know, the philosophy, the questioning, I've got a would you rather for our listeners. So the would you rather this week is, would you rather give up driving forever or give up eating meat forever? And there are environmental reasons as to why this is a relevant question, which we'll go into a little bit further down. Charlie, I'm not going to ask you straight away what you think. I'm going to let you ponder and get that mind working. But if anyone has an opinion out there, you can tweet us at Soho Radio. We would love to know what you think. And now time for some music. So Charlie, you have chosen the songs today, and could you tell me, what are we going to have first?
Could we go for the George Benson song, Give Me the Night? It's weird because it's a song about the night, but for me it's such a good waking up song. It just puts me in such a good mood.
We'll see the people of the world coming out to dance, cause there's music in the air and lots of loving everywhere. So give me the night. Give me the night.
Give Me the Night by George Benson, number one song choice from Charlie Cotton this morning. Thanks for that, Charlie. It was uplifting, I'd say.
It's got a good feeling. I often had that on my house until a Sunday morning, just making coffee. Yeah, again, you can't really listen to the lyrics too much because it's kind of about, you know, sort of going out or whatever.
Give you the night, but it's the morning. And now we're going to segue smoothly into a little section I like to call Science News, 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 News. So top stories this week, there's two actually that I really, really got excited about. Firstly, a warm-blooded fish has been discovered. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, it looks ridiculously cute as well. I think even in the article that I was reading about it, they described him as a tubby little predator, which kind of made me smile, but yeah.
Yeah, and it's like a metre long and doesn't look like it should be able to swim very well. But so it's called an opa, which sounds a bit more like a precious stone than anything else.
Yeah, exactly.
And Yeah, it can keep itself sort of at least 10 degrees warmer than the sea around it, which, and this is amazing because most, there's kind of two types of animals, wouldn't you say? The warm-blooded and the cold-blooded.
Sure, yeah, let's split it into categories like that. It's useful.
And the advantages of being warm-blooded are that your reactions are much faster, but it's also very energetically costly to keep your body warm when your heat is just radiating into the surroundings that are so much colder than you, and particularly in water. Yeah. It's very rare to have... In fact, I think this is the first fish they've ever found that's warm-blooded because the water just saps your heat. So did you see how it keeps itself warm?
Yeah, so what I liked about this article, or at least the one I read, was it was telling me that scientists, because this is how science really happens, like, he basically, they had the gills, and that's that was kind of like the teller for him, and there was just this guy who's, like, known as the gill guy, so it's clearly, that's just his thing, and then he just had them for ages, and then opened them up and was kind of like, sort of like Eureka, but that's how it is, you know, there'll be things just sort of laying around for months on end, and then you'll just get this kind of like, beautiful, that's exactly something crazy and something new that I've never seen before, so... what I know about is sort of the gill structure, but I don't know, like, if and also I read that it's got massive muscles, because that made me giggle a little bit, but I don't actually know how it generates the heat. Is it just by sort of flexing, or what does it do?
So it's pectoral muscles, which are the ones that it uses to sort of flap its fins. So it beats its fins, and those generate heat.
Yeah.
And then the blood vessels going into the fins get warmed up by the heat in the muscle, and then they've got this huge layer of fat around them. And they're structured in such a way that all these blood vessels are very closely linked, and the ones going back to the body come beside the ones that are going out to the fins, and they sort of heat each other up. It's called a counter-current exchange method. And because of all the fat, it doesn't lose the heat to the water. And so the blood that got warmed up by the muscle in the fin then heads to the heart and the brain, and it's nice and warm when it arrives there.
So not to make too much of a segue to what we were talking about earlier, but this is a massive thing in the kind of renewable energy stuff I work in now. It's like biomimicry, looking at what nature does, because it's so resource limited, nature. And then taking some examples from that. So that apparently, you know, the article I was reading said it looks a lot like a heat exchanger, so we design things for that very purpose, or like if you imagine a radiator, that kind of function, or for like cooling on the back of a refrigerator. So, and taking some of those principles and sort of moving them into wherever they're relevant here. So like this, so it's got really strong pressures to like stay warm and not spend too much energy doing it.
Yeah, because the more energy it spends, the more it has to eat.
Exactly. So, and just this kind of like fatty layer around it. You know, it's not always, you know, like you can't always move ideas from one to the other, but there's been a couple of pretty successful
examples.
So we
should cover our radiators in fat.
Yeah, we should. Yeah.
Cover our rooms in fat and our houses in fat. Fat is the answer.
But it's really fun to think about. And actually, there's quite a lot of designers who thought that way for a long time before science caught up with it, actually. So there was a fellow, what's his name? It'll come to me in a bit, but he was, you know, obsessed with looking at seeds from sycamore trees and how they come down, you know, the ones come down like helicopters.
Yeah. I used to catch them as a kid in the playground.
Yeah. And for a while, that kind of wasn't functional research, but now that's definitely coming back into the limelight as a thing people are getting interested in, and there's funding going towards it.
As a way of making sort of flying vehicles that are efficient?
Yeah, or? Just looking at it for everything. So we kind of do the same with photosynthesis, but it's a little bit further. But these mechanical things, it's really obviously transitive. There's a really cool video, actually, maybe we can put it on the Twitter, of my friend showed me the other day, of like a sponge, you know, like a coral reef sponge. And then you put dye on the outside and it goes... and shoot straight out of the center, and it's like if you think about designing a building maybe for like proper ventilation, and you can look at the sort of surface structure of the sponge and kind of emulate that. I mean,
that is really cool. Okay, we will definitely tweet that. We'll find it during the next song break and nice tweet video. It for you. So check that out on our Twitter at Soho Radio. The first ever warm-blooded fish, and that's so cool because we thought all fish were cold-blooded, and now, just like the duckbill platypus, we found an exception to the rule. The next science story that I got really excited about was in Cuba, for a while now, they've had a vaccine for lung cancer.
Wow.
And okay, so this is crazy because cancer is a disease where your cells multiply out of control. And it's normally to do with some sort of control mechanisms within your cells that have gone a bit wrong, either saying divide, 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 or the thing that says don't divide has got wrong. So you wouldn't have thought that, I mean, it's not infectious. It's not, apart from human papillomavirus, which can cause cervical cancer, it's not really caused by a virus. But this isn't a preventative vaccine. It doesn't stop you getting lung cancer. But what it does seem to do, there's only been a small study at the moment, is slow the growth with way less side effects than some of our current medications.
So what are they kind of putting in? What's in it? Do you know? Is it like...
So one of the things that encourages cell growth is something called the epidermal growth factor, and this is a protein. Uh-huh. And particularly for lung and head and neck cancers, so some regions at the top of your body, this epidermal growth factor really affects their growth. Yeah. So if you can have less of it in those cells, they won't be able to grow as well.
Okay.
And so what this vaccine does is it will it has another protein attached to the epidermal growth factor, and it trains your body to create antibodies against the epidermal growth factor.
Cheeky.
So then your body starts to remove this protein all of its own accord, and you have less in your body, and therefore it slows down the growth of those cancers.
Yeah, it's really cool.
And there's a similar, like, breast cancer is encouraged if you have high levels of estrogen, apparently, I read.
Yeah.
So there are lots of factors in your body where just kind of changing the environment that the cancer is in can help to slow it down.
Yeah, that's a huge field of study, just looking at the local surroundings of a cancer and so on. But it's so difficult because cancer is so many different kinds of diseases and so many different kinds of body. But sometimes these big systemic changes, like finding one thing, because so a growth factor will typically affect, you know, hundreds of things about the way a cell will work. So those kind of targets have a lot of promise.
Yeah. And so it's used in hospitals in Cuba at the moment, and they've just started to do a big study on it in Canada. And I think there's been a lot of talk about how, you know, it's going to come across to America and they're going to start really looking into it really seriously.
Cool,
so, yeah, they're labeling it as, you know, the crumbling of the Cuba-American feud has created this medical amazingness. So I thought that was really, really exciting.
Well, I think we're adapting some stuff from the Cuban medical system, I think particularly on the preventative side, because again, they were, I guess, in some sort of like a relationship as well to the biomimicry stuff before. They were sort of resource strapped, so they looked for where they could really make a lot of improvement for little money. And with medicine, the answer is often preventative, right? So like exercise programs for young kids and so on. So I think we're taking some of those lessons as well. But that's cool that they've got this high-tech stuff as well.
Yeah, prevention, better than the cure. And then the final bit of science news that I thought was really cool and also a bit silly was that one group of scientists have used x-rays to reveal how chocolate turns white.
Yeah, it's important.
Really, really important. No one wants to eat chocolate when it looks like it's moldy. I mean, I know it's not mold, but when it's all white and you just know it's not going to taste as good. So this white, the white discoloration that you get on chocolate is formed by, it's known as a fat bloom, when really? The liquid fat, such as cocoa butter from the chocolate, migrates through the chocolate structure and just kind of crystallizes on the surface. And what they did was they kind of made like a powdered up bit of chocolate, all the correct ingredients, and then using really high powered x-rays, they looked down at the crystal structure of chocolate, like right down to like nanoscale, and then they put some sunflower oil onto their powder and observed how the oil moves through, and it's to do like with the porous spaces between the crystal structure. And so they were saying if you could make a less porous version of chocolate, then it wouldn't get the fat bloom as quickly, so your chocolate would last longer before it went white.
Fair enough.
All about structure.
I think that's because I was you know, if you leave chocolate in the car and you come back the day after when it's gone hot and then cold. So I guess when it goes hot, all the fat comes out and pools together and then goes cold again.
And it gets all shiny on the surface and all oily and greasy. Yeah.
But I mean, that's like, we joke that that's not important research, but chocolate means a lot to a lot of people. So, you know, we got to know more about it.
Long lasting chocolate. That could be a hit sale. Right. It's definitely time for some more music. So, Charlie, what have we got coming up next?
Let's play the track Durga 2. So this is by a band from New Orleans called Generationals. But yeah, it's just... Yeah, go ahead.
Ooh, it doesn't really want to play.
Oh, no.
Might have to go into
that's fine as well.
So many details. Apologies for that technical error, but we enjoyed the first drum beat of Durga 2. That was so nice and chilled. I really enjoyed that sort of synthing away on the waves. Thanks, Charlie. So if you've just joined us, you are listening to the Saturday Science Club on Soho Radio. It is Saturday morning, unsurprisingly, here in London, and we are in the heart of Soho. You can come and say hi. We're at 22 Great Wimble Street, and you can see us through the window from the coffee shop. Although sadly, there's no coffee right now. And if you weren't listening earlier, we started this show with a bit of a would you rather question. And that was, would you rather give up eating meat forever or give up driving forever? Quite a difficult question, I think. And very relevant to our theme of today, which is the environment. So one of the reasons that inspired this Would You Rather was actually Charlie, with me here today, was the inspiration why I became vegetarian about a year and a half ago. And this was Charlie telling me that, well, he did it himself. He became veggie. And, you know, you always ask your friends, oh, why are you veggie? Is it because, you know, you object to the killing of animals or what? And he said, no, it's the single way that you as a person can have an impact towards helping prevent global warming. And that just struck me as amazing. Charlie, can you tell me a bit more about where that comes from and how we kind of think that that works?
Yeah, sure. So it's funny. It's quite a touchy issue for lots of people because there's a lot of moral high ground and stuff. But I really do stand by that point, I think. So there's like tons and tons of reviews and papers and literature about the issue, and it's really hard to quantify. But I come back to this sort of UN report from 2006, which says sort of agricultural livestock is roughly 18% of our total global emissions, right? And mm-hmm. as I say, these numbers are really hard to put like fixed things on. The error bars could be as much as 10% on that figure. But if we talk about this seriously, if that's even a possibility that it's as high as that, It's a really serious way that as an individual, because most of our problems are sort of communal problems, community problems, like how do we deal with something like a bus transport system? But this is something you can just be like, I'm going to take this on my back and do this thing. And yeah, and it's an issue really of perception as well, because so many of us were brought up eating so much meat. Like I was 3 times a day, you know,
yeah.
But it's, and I think it's all about the way you go about it, right? Because I don't know how your experience has been since you changed, but some people are really against it. But I think there's loads of really nice ways to talk about the issues in a non-preachy way. Just sort of, I think one of the biggest ways sort of we were working on it was like cooking together, right? Like teaching someone a really delicious yeah. meal that's A, cheaper, B, healthier, C, like doesn't have any meat.
That's something that people really like, actually. Like, yeah, it's so much cheaper being a vegetarian. Yeah. Like, it's great. And I've really got into corn. I feel like you can still make your, you know, bolognese, but with corn bolognese, not, you don't have to have beef or lamb,
yeah.
and it tastes just as good.
You learn how to spice properly. There's so many positives, but I think it's an important point to stress that there's this like difficult era, like sort of issue around perception of it, right? And like the thing that you're not pointing out, everyone's being bad by doing a certain thing. I think the optimum would be, and it's something maybe some of my more hardcore vegetarian friends don't understand, is that it's much better for two people to eat, you know, less than half as much meat than for one person to go fully veggie. Because again, all of these climate issues are big problems. Mm. Like our sort of like individualist way of approaching these isn't necessarily the best. But so like, it's much better to like share a vegetarian meal with a friend than it is to like look at them, make them feel guilty about their steak, right? It's got to be this sort of like, sort of together thing. But yeah, it's definitely.
It's all about reducing demand, I suppose. I mean, yeah. If the agricultural industry had less demand and was smaller, that would be bringing the emissions down.
Yeah.
And so I guess if everyone was like, I'm only going to eat meat twice a week rather than half the people giving it up forever.
Yeah.
I can see. Yeah. I see what you mean.
It's a lot in habits as well. That's the main thing, right? Like you know how to cook certain things. That's what you do. And it's habits that you can change. I think a lot of people kind of like, there was a lot of deriding of the issue when it first came out as well, because people would just be like, oh, it's just cows farting. It's not that big a deal. But actually agriculture is a huge part of our global emissions. Like, so another thing people don't really understand about the issue is we grow, like cows don't really eat grass in most of the world today. They eat soybeans, which are grown on like big industrial farms with tons of inputs. And then the cows eat the grain, which we could eat. Like admittedly, we wouldn't want to eat that much soy ourselves, but we could alternatively use that land for different crops that we would eat ourselves. So
yeah, it's deforestation. It's inefficient, like growing food to feed to a cow to then eat the cow.
Yeah, and water usage is a huge, so that's when I talk about like, you know, these error bars on these calculations. It's because it's a global phenomenon, and the rise of meat in the BRIC countries, so Brazil and like India and these sort of places, is going to have a huge effect in their local agricultural environment. So the deforestation issue you hit on is and was, and I think continues to be huge. I don't know how much it's still in the media in Brazil. So that was, they were cutting down rainforest to have grazing land for cattle. And it's all these sort of systemic things that people don't necessarily think about, because when you buy like meat from Tesco's, you might just assume it comes from up the road. And in some cases it might, but most of us, when we go to a restaurant, don't ask, check, we can't. It's just habits, right?
I think that's a really important thing as well. And that's something I've thought about myself, because people are like, oh, are you going to be a veggie for your whole life? And I'm kind of like, I don't know if I'll be a full vegetarian for my whole life. But maybe when I'm a bit older and I kind of know where the meat is coming from, I'd be happy to, you know, buy some meat a few times a week if I know it's from like a farm really close by and you haven't had loads of emissions transporting it within a boat or a plane or anything. And actually, this doesn't just apply to meat. I mean, you've got to think about where are your apples coming from and and where is everything coming from. And I think it's really nice, and more restaurants should do this. Like, I went to Franco Manca the other day, and it tells you exactly where they get all their different like tomatoes and stuff from, and at the different times of year. And I was like, that's great. But until we have that information, I think I found it easier just to be like, I'm vegetarian. And therefore, I'm just like, that's safe.
That's exactly how I felt at the beginning of it now. And it's a weird one in that. So for me, it's like, you don't need to go full Morrissey about these things and be like, you know, or like, you know, covering people in blood or whatever. I think you can do some good at any level you choose to engage, and there's so many reasons. For me, it's also like the energy stuff. Like, if you're not into, if you're a massive climate change denier, you can still want to switch to renewable energy for energy security. So like, you don't want to be importing oil from countries
you're
not.
Oil will run out one day.
Yeah. So there's other reasons, and the same with sort of this diet thing. Like, the majority, like, I have a strong history of like heart disease in my family, and the majority of men sort of like over 40 will go onto statins at some point, just because our society eats too much meat. And so like, even if I didn't, so for me, it's like my first encouragement to reduce my meat intake was the climate, and then after that was maybe financial, and then maybe after that there's some animal welfare issues, because, but like, I haven't got rid of all of those because I still drink milk and so on. But you know, these were all contributing factors. And then finally, health, right? If you don't care about any of these things, I know sort of 50-year-old men who are as macho as anything who are now cutting down on their meat because their doctor's telling them you've just got to, right? So it's they're talking about habit changing for society and how you go about it. There's a lot of interesting things about the psychology of it, though. So when I first started being vegetarian, I was like super hardcore, black and white, this is okay, this isn't okay. And after 4 years of that, I kind of came back and I was like, I need to change the way I'm looking at the issue, because that can cause you stress as well. So it's about changing your perception of a problem. So it's got really hippie all of a sudden. But like, so a weird thing now is I recognize, you know, I used to go to the sandwich counter and be like, oh, I can get this rubbish vegetarian sandwich. And by the way, vegetarian sandwiches are a massive hole in the market, if anyone's willing to just plug that one.
Hummus sandwich, cheese.
More cheese.
Everyone just gives you cheese.
but now I'm getting to stages where I'm going up and I'm looking at the two options and deciding, actually, I really genuinely want the other one more because someone's put effort into it.
Yeah, so. I have something to admit, actually, having sat here being like, I'm vegetarian. I'm training for a quadathlon, and I have been struggling to get enough protein because it's a lot more exercise than I'd normally be doing.
Sure. You've got to be conscious of these things.
I've been eating some protein bars. Never done that before. But after talking to my mum, who's a doctor, we kind of agreed that for the next 2 months until the big day, I'm going to eat a little bit of meat again. So
I think, and you shouldn't be embarrassed to say it. Like, it's all about making a contribution when you can, where you can, and not like, we're so rude to each other about moral high ground, right? We're like, oh, you said this and now you did this. And it's like, everyone's trying, but everyone's human as well, you know? So there's no point in getting each other's back.
Exactly. And I think this is the perfect time to go to some songs.
Should we play it? So this was the first single I ever bought. And when someone asked me to find music, I was like, it's maybe a bit cheesy, but I'll dedicate it to my girlfriend. So here you are, Ira. First one. Yeah, yeah.
This is All My Life. Was All My Life by KCI and JoJo, Charlie's third choice, and dedicated to his girlfriend Ira. Ira, if you're listening, I hope you enjoyed that.
She'll be in bed. It's much too early for that.
She can listen again on Mixcloud, as can everyone. So if you've just joined us, it's the Saturday Science Club, and now it's time for our weekly experiment. So if you are going to join us at home, all you need is a fizzy drink. We have chosen lemonade, but other drinks are available. Some sort of glass to pour your drink into, and some raisins. And what we're going to do is literally just pour out our drink.
It sounds so smooth over the radio.
Yeah. Doesn't, yeah. You can hear those bubbles fizzing. There you go. So nice fizzy drink. And we're going to drop some raisins into this glass. What do you think will happen, Charlie?
I should mention I'm a raisin enthusiast.
This is true. Me and Charlie used to live together, and I came home one day and he had created an experiment where he just put a raisin in a glass of water. I think you left it there for like over a week to see if you could turn it back into a grape.
Yeah, and it just didn't work. I was heartbroken. So I did it in like 10 glasses of all different kinds of salt and a little bit of sugar and stuff, and I couldn't get it all the way. But
you did get one to swell up loads. Yeah, it still looked kind of raisin coloured.
Yeah.
But
it was close. So I you know, after that experiment, I can say I safely know nothing about raisins and how they're going to react with liquid. So let's find out. I've got no idea.
Okay, so here we go. I'm going to put in my first raisin, and it has sunk to the bottom, and so has the second and the third. Yep. So currently all these raisins are sinking to the bottom. That's fine. Oh, and now they've risen to the top. Two of them have floated up. Oh, and it's falling down again. These raisins are sinking and falling alternatively. This is known as the dancing raisins experiment, and it's really super cool. So basically, the way it works, I'm just going to pop a few more in. Let's have a real party, a raisin party. How it works is, because raisins have a really wrinkly surface, the bubbles in the drink get stuck on the surface of the raisins. So when they're at the bottom, and bubbles are forming all the time in a fizzy drink because it's the carbon dioxide escaping from the liquid, and so these bubbles will form and they'll stick to the raisin. And raisins are only a tiny, tiny bit more dense than water, so they're only a little bit heavier, making them sink. And once they have enough bubbles stuck to them, it makes them slightly lighter than the water with this push from the bubbles, and they rise to the top. But then at the top, the bubbles escape, so they fall back down. And this is our
tiny raisin elevator.
Yeah. So they're dancing up and dancing back down. And that is the dancing raisin experiment. You can do this at home, and then you can drink it and eat all the raisins. So it's just the best way to spend your Saturday.
It's pretty immediate, actually. You kind of like, it's like you could make a bet. You could number the raisins. You could number the raisins and then like give them little flags and then guess which one's going to come to the top, and you could like choose the best raisin.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's maybe the worst game in the world, but I might actually do that alone. Quickly become gambling.
And also, when I was sort of looking into this experiment a little bit more, I discovered that a more adult version of this is, so say you've had like a nice dinner party and there's been some Prosecco or some champagne, something bubbly and alcoholic. And after a couple of hours of this bottle being open, it's a little bit flat, doesn't taste quite as good. You can't, you know, taste the stars, as the famous quote suggests. All you need to do is put some raisins into this slightly flat bottle, and again, because of their structure, they kind of attract the last bits of carbon dioxide out of the liquid, and they rebubble it for a little bit. They reignite that fizz. I mean, it doesn't work on a bottle that's been left in your fridge for days, but a few hours, it's all good.
How human is this? I've chosen a favourite raisin. I like one raisin better than the others for no good reason whatsoever. This one, he's such a trier. Look at that.
Oh, he just keeps going and falling.
Yeah,
because some of the others have got to the top and they're chilling for a while. They're like, they're holding on to their bubbles.
Yeah.
They need to roll around a bit.
He's the underdog.
Anyway, I think that's enough chat about raisins. So if we could have my phone back, please. We have filmed that and we will be putting it up online. We're going to go straight into another song. And while you're at home, I want you to be thinking about, would you rather become a vegetarian and give up meat forever, or stop driving forever? Because driving is another cause of lots of emissions that are affecting our global warming. Tweet us in at Soho Radio. And let us know what you think. I have a sneaking suspicion, just from kind of my talking to other people about this, that more boys are going to give up driving and more girls are going to give up meat. Yeah, whenever I tell a boy I'm vegetarian, they're like, oh, just couldn't give up meat. But anyway, our next song, would you like to introduce it, Charlie?
Yeah, this is For Once in My Life by Stevie Wonder. It's feel good. It's a Saturday.
Let's go. Yeah, yeah, yeah. For once in my life, I won't let sorrow hurt me. Hurt me before. For once I have something I know won't desert me. I'm not alone anymore. For once I can say this is mine, you can't take it. Long as I know I have love, I can make it. For once in my life, I have someone who needs me. That was was For Once in My Life by Stevie Wonder. You're listening to the Saturday Science Club on Soho Radio, and this is the part of the show where we get to find out more about my guest this week. So my guest is Charlie Cotton, and Charlie is a PhD student at Imperial working on photosynthesis and how to make it more efficient and whether we can use it ourselves for renewable energy. So this sounds like the coolest of topics, Charlie. How did you first get into it and decide? Well, actually, two questions here. When did you first become really interested in the environment? Because we talked a lot about that this show already. And then what led you into this particular PhD?
Cool. So I always make the claim that I guess I was a bit of a hippie before I was a scientist. So I kind of imagined I was going to go and do chemistry undergraduate and then come out and go straight to business, do some business things, and then kind of keep my environment stuff on the go that way. But as I sort of went further and further in my career, I was kind of like, oh, actually, I really like the science stuff, and this seems like I can really make an input in an interesting way. So I was into environment, I guess. I was the university environmental officer in second year
at
university.
Yeah, you were. So, QC environmental officer.
Well, yeah, with the election recently, there was a picture of me on Facebook with Handan Miliband, because he was Senate environment officer at the time. So I was handing him a petition with some people, and I was like, wow, that's a blast from the past, because that must have been 2012.
What was he like in real life?
Well, we only met very briefly. It was a massive demonstration, but he was very kind. It was just a very brief meeting. You know, I guess politicians do
that
sort of stuff.
That's a good question. I've been listening to far too much demos.
I don't know. I think my dad had something to do with it. My dad was working with like a small manufacturing company for a long time, and we're from the Northwest originally, and it was like recycling tires into stuff that goes under carpets. So he was always, and he still is now, really interested in like solar thermal energy and like. But he's always been interested in that kind of stuff. And it's kind of revived again for him because he's been doing a lot of like diving stuff. So I think there was some sort of family stuff there. And then for me, I just think it is the overriding problem of our times. I think we got to deal with it. And it's a super interesting problem to play with because we know what's going on. We know that the biggest thing around it is behavioral change. But it's so hard to...
Yeah.
It's such an interesting problem to work on, right? And there are no easy answers. But it's so exciting as well because you just don't know where technology and/or just how communities are going to change to respond to it. But I think I was kind of this sort of egotist who wanted to work on what I thought was the most important problem. So that's why I got into it. And then how I get to the PhD. So I was always playing with algae. When I was finishing my undergraduate, there was a lot of talk about it. And it's an interesting topic to talk about in itself, sort of the hype around science, right? So when you see like these futurology posts like algae is going to save the world, what does it actually mean? But I was strung in by those at the very beginning. Mm. And I'm really lucky in that my PhD hasn't been one of those, one that's like super focused on an output. I work in pure research. So that's kind of like understanding why things happen upstream of
making the technologies and having something.
There's still some of that technology going on. Some of the distilleries in Scotland are pretty big on filtering their flue gases. So the stuff that comes out of their factories through algae to capture some of the CO2 again.
Carbon capture.
Yeah, well, so but carbon capture, okay, now I'm going to go so off the record, on the record. I don't think that the stuff that oil companies do with like CCS is a real thing. But I mean, anyone feel free to tweet at me about that because I'd love to have a conversation. But
so just quickly for anyone that doesn't know what carbon capture is, it's the idea where you put a chemical or a material that kind of attracts carbon and binds with it in like a chimney. Yeah. So as the fumes are leaving the chimney, the carbon dioxide is extracted from the fumes and binds to this material. And hopefully you are then not releasing as much CO2 into the atmosphere.
And they also use energy to like pressurize it, put it back underground and things like that. And in theory, all the bit parts of the technology are there, but I've never seen a demonstration. But, you know, I'm probably going to get binned for that. But, but anyway, so like it turns out that plants do this naturally, right? They take carbon dioxide out of the air. That's the original carbon capture, if you will.
Yeah.
There's big, complicated cycles to it. But before you start investing in heavy technologies for, you know, for catching flue gas, just like if you spent that money preserving rainforest, it would be better pound for pound, I bet you. Like it's really hard to do those studies, but sometimes you just got to go on gut feeling because the energy intensity of that kind of process, the kinds of things you're getting out, like for me, they're bit parts and your money can be spent better elsewhere. But anyway.
I actually, at my old school when I was about 11, we always had to choose a charity for the year for our class to raise money for. And every year I campaigned, let's save the rainforest. And every year no one voted for me because they're like, we want to save people, not plants. And I was like, but when the sea levels rise, all the people are going to die.
It's what I was saying about it being an interesting project because there are so many different facets to this problem, right? Once I was kind of responsible in some ways for teaching an undergraduate course on climate change and imperial. And someone in the after a lecture from like a big keynote speaker just raised his hand. He's like, it seems like we don't need any more technology. It seems like most of these problems are behavioral. And it was just like bang, spot on in the room. Mm. I mean, technology is great because humans know how to deal with it very well. We can roll out, if you look at the rollout of something like Uber, like 2 years ago, no one knew what it was. Now it's on everyone's phone everywhere.
Yeah,
like
whether sort of you're
pro or con or whatever. Yeah. Technology can move very fast, whereas behavioral change is very slow and difficult, but might be more important. So there's these things to think about, but obviously I'm in the technology camp for the moment because research.
And I love hearing about really cool kind of social enterprises. So the other day, a mutual friend of ours, Emma Shaw, was telling me about this campaign called Gravity Light. And it's the idea, it's like a really old fashioned idea of kind of generating electricity just by having a big weight that falls slowly. So using gravity to move this rock down and that turns something and that generates light.
Yeah.
And it takes about 2 or 3 hours for the rock to fall and then you have to reset it. Yeah. But I mean, if you're in like a rural farm somewhere in the middle of nowhere, you've got no grid connection, you have your rock and your LED that it powers.
Yeah.
And that's just incredible. And it's completely clean light.
Some of these things, like, so the one thing was biomimicry, looking at nature, but also there's a lot of stuff looking at old civilizations now where they didn't have these things. So if you think about real free sources of energy, there's the sun, there's the wind, and there's gravity, right? Like, to me, at least. There's others if you want to think about it. But even things like growing a tree, you're taking something out of the ground at some level in terms of resource, like phosphate or whatever. But gravity is an interesting one, because we were sort of, so there was this, you know, like environmental challenge I was on, and one of the ideas that me and my friend were joking around about is like, why is a zip line such a bad way to get around a city? Obviously it's got massive health problems because, you know, people fall off and that, but gravity is really free energy. Like, and
yeah,
I don't know if you heard about the mayor's plan, it was ages ago and they got binned, but it was for the bounce way. Did you see that?
No.
It was going to be a walkway that was all trampolines, and it was meant to like encourage people to not get in the tube, bus, car or whatever, and just go by trampoline, and they sort of some exercise as well, but people didn't want public money spent on that.
Oh my god, that sounds amazing. Well, why do we not have zip wires and trampoline pavements? Yeah. That would be great. So wait, you were on this course called the London Environmental Challenge.
Yeah, yeah. So that was really exciting. That was very recently, actually. And it was a two-week residential course set up by Imperial, the Grantham Institute. So those of you interested in climate change, the Grantham Institute is sort of like our Imperial College's like central like research hub for it. And they work with people in lots of different departments. So we had 20, maybe 25 PhD students from all over the UK. Actually, some of them came from Holland and stuff. And this is the first year it's running, so it's pretty impressive. And tons of different disciplines. So you had people who were like working on retrofitting houses, and then people who like studied earthquakes. So like bizarre mixes of PhD disciplines.
But that's the best way to get innovation, is when you have lots of different ideas in a room.
Yeah, you hear it a lot, but I didn't really believe it myself until this time, because you really did get different perspectives. Like, I was working with a guy who's like head gardener at a really cool facility, and like, so I had, and I love plants anyway, so it was nice to sort of get that back and forth about some interesting ideas we were working on. But yeah, so the idea was we had to get together and sort of come up with our best ideas for London and how to in 2 weeks. So the first week was kind of get exposed to a lot of different ideas. And one cool thing is like district heating that I hadn't thought about. So in Enfield are really forward thinking council about this, actually. They're trying to get together, I think it's like a heat network. So basically, and it's an idea that's been going on in like Scandinavia for a long time. And it's difficult to implement in some ways. But like the basic point being, you have rubbish anyway, and you have incinerator plants in London. Why not use the heat generated from that to distribute like heating to a local network?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and it's kind of a different idea. And like, it's funny because, you know, in England, we've got such a mishmash of different sort of services that have just, you know, because like after the Industrial Revolution, we kind of sort of patched it all together. And like our grid is kind of like, it's complicated, for lack of a better word. So we're having to deal with a lot of like retrofitting of services and stuff. But like that seems like one that can go forward. And so
and finding ways to supplement the grid is incredibly important, because you told me this amazing statistic a few days ago, which has blown my mind and continues to blow my mind. So I really want to share it today. And that was that. So, you know, if you're watching TV and then in an ad break, everyone makes tea.
Yeah.
And that huge rush of, you know, millions of people suddenly putting on the kettle. Our grid can't cope with that extra peak, and we import nuclear energy from France.
So, yeah, I think, yeah, like, it's nuts. It's, well, there's a, what's the word for it? It's like a TV kickback or something, setback? I can't remember.
You can TV
find,
pickup.
You can find it on Wikipedia. So I don't know how much the fact, maybe I was sensationalizing it. I want to just be a scientist for a moment and say, definitely we put capacity online for France, and I'm sure we have imported once or twice.
Okay,
but like, maybe we should moderate it. But yeah. But like, definitely, you can see these huge spikes in demand. And actually, that was one of the things at this environmental challenge. So in the old days, quote unquote, we used to have mobile tariffs for electricity. So it was called demand side sort of modeling, right? Which is like, I can choose when I want to use cheap or expensive electricity. And we still do this for industry. Like if you're a mining company or whatever, I don't know if they still exist, and you have in the UK some sort of really energy intensive process, you do it with cheap electricity at a given time, and then the provider gives you that, because that's actually a really difficult thing to do, is balance out your energy loads. So it's another thing for people to think about. But the TV.
Just quickly, we are running out of time so much. And Charlie, you're such an interesting person, but I just want to sneak in, talking about Wikipedia articles, was there not a phase in your life when you were a Wikipedia editor?
Yeah, it was a rogue phase. I have the t-shirt and everything. No, it was cool, because so you spend all this time building up all this knowledge, and then how are you giving back? And it was funny, because even for the most specialist topics I'm interested in, there'd be someone who'd got there with like a one-liner before or whatever. So I was working on this protein complex, I don't know how technical we should get, but I was working on this really specific protein complex that maybe like 3 people in the world care about. Uh-huh. And there was already a little article up for it, but yeah. So, but it's amazing when you look at the statistics of the people that produce to the people that consume Wikipedia. If you've got something you care about, I really encourage you to go on and have a look at the article and see where you can prove it, because it's such a resource. I love it so much.
And finally, I could talk about possible ways of sort of saving the planet all day, but you have actually just been on a course you were telling me something about innovation that people can get involved in. Do you want to quickly just say that very quickly?
So a friend introduced me to the other day. So MIT have got this thing called Climate Colab, and I'm sure we can put the link online for you. And it's basically an open innovation platform for climate-related issues. So they put up a challenge, and you write in a written proposal, and there's like given prizes at the end, right? So I don't know if people have seen Innocentive, which is like the kind of thing for like maybe science research that they do that for. But this is for, and it's like a, all you've got to do is have an idea, do some basic research, come up with some basic answers, and submit it. And then there's prizes that involve you, like maybe even starting a business out of this. You know, if it's a good idea, get flown somewhere to talk to someone about it. It just seems like a fun opportunity to think about some really discrete problems they're putting up.
So if you've been inspired by some of the things you've heard today, I'm feeling inspired right now, I have to say. Check it out. And if you've got any of your own ideas burning away, then get them out there, because that is how we make changes in this world. And finally, so we gave you a would you rather. Would you rather give up meat for forever or give up driving forever? And I think sadly it's still a little bit early and no one has actually tweeted in an answer. But we've got Charlie. So Charlie, what would your answer to that be? It's quite hard.
Oof. So I would rather give up meat, I think, just because I'm a late comer to driving. I just passed my test this December.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. But I think I got it because I was like, there's some parts in the world where you're always going to need to drive. Like if you're in really, really rural America or something like that, or really, really rural Italy or something like that. But I think for me, the transition to less meat is very possible. And there's entire swathes of humanity that just do it as habit, you know?
Yeah.
Well,
thank you so much for coming on the show today. I'm really sad that is all we've got time for. And we are going to leave you with Charlie's final choice, which is Better Together by Jack Johnson.
Our dreams, and they are made out of real things, like a shoebox of photographs with sepia tone loving. Love is the answer, at least for most of the questions of my heart. Like, why are we here and where do we go? And knock on us so hard. It's not always easy and sometimes life can be deceiving. I'll tell you one thing, it's always better when we're together. It's always better when we're together. Yeah, we'll look at them stars.